Okay, it's almost 3:30 on Saturday, February 19th, and Shores and I, Wayne Ranney, have migrated down to the River Ranger Station, and we're sitting on the picnic table to the south of the Ranger Station. And Shores, where we left off was November 15th, 1988. 89, I'm sorry.
No, 88.
Was 88?
88.
November 18th, 1988, and you had just come down to begin your first day at Phantom Ranch. What do you recall from that day?
Let's see. Well, I met two other volunteers. They were SCAs.
Okay.
And they were also moving in.
Oh, so three of you arrived on the same day.
Yeah, on the same time. And they were on a... Their project was to... the fish thing, they were surveying fish, or they were interviewing fishermen here.
Okay.
That's when there were like as many as 30 people fishing here.
Right.
That, yeah.
Do you remember the SEA's names?
Yeah, Rich Lechneichner. And then, I can't remember what his last name. At least not off the bat.
Okay, and how long were they supposed to be here?
3 months.
3 months.
Yeah.
And how long were you supposed to be here?
3 months.
Wow. So you were you hired in this position to be the fish guy with them?
No.
Okay.
No, I was, Dan Otrogi is one who hired me.
Okay.
Yeah. And it, you know, so yeah. So yeah, I got there and started working.
Wow. You had no idea at that time how long this would turn into. You were just...
Yeah, so what happened was, when it got close to the 3 months, that we had a get together here, and I was talking to Dan, and then I don't know exactly how the conversation went, but basically, Dan says, "Yeah, it's too bad you can't stay down here." And I said, "Well, yeah, I'd rather stay down here." And he goes, "I thought you wanted to go back to the North Rim." "Oh no, I'd rather be down here." And I said, "Yeah, and I said there's a housing problem on the South Rim though," and I go, "I don't need housing.
I'll be down here."
And so that's how it changed.
Okay, who was the duty ranger at Phantom Ranch on November 15th?
That I don't know. I can't remember who, but
okay.
But that, I think Rick Mossman was around. I'm not sure on that one day, but Rick Mossman was working down here.
Okay.
And Patty.
Oh, Patty was here?
Yeah, Patty was
okay.
Here.
Okay.
Yeah, and then later on, closer to summer, Brian Wisher started working here.
And that was his first duty at Phantom Ranch?
I don't know if it was his first duty, but because he was already in the corps.
He was at Indian Gardens.
Yeah, he was in Indian Gardens, yeah.
Okay, so that would have been the summer of 89. And so at least Brian Wisher was here early on in your career. And
yeah.
You formed a nice bond with him, I assume?
Yeah.
Yeah. I remember Brian being the ranger down here, and
yeah.
I'll just interject one story about Brian. I was in number 33... the Barren group site, and Brian came through probably about 2 p.m. after we arrived from Cottonwood.
Mm-hmm.
And I made a little complaint about how rocky the campsite was. And Brian was the kind of guy that listened to campers and acted on campers, and he came back with a wheelbarrow and a shovel and a pick and started removing the protruding rocks that I had been complaining about. And I thought that was the most incredible thing. And, of course, I jumped in and helped him with it, you know, with the pick or the shovel and getting those rocks out. And that was my first introduction to Brian Wisher, who I would call a ranger's ranger.
Yeah. We're, him and Kim are like, you know, my best friends.
Okay.
Even now.
They're your best friends even now.
Yeah.
Cool. And Patty was fun to work with.
I mean,
Patty was a real Phantom Ranch ranger. And,
uh-huh.
You reminded me earlier this morning that she did at least two stints down here.
Yeah.
I think she went to Tuzagoot to get her permanent position and then came back
Could
as
be,
a permanent.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Well, I don't know where you want to go from here. We don't have to do it chronologically, but...
Yeah.
Try to recall some of those early days when you were just getting to know Phantom Ranch. For example, when you were living down here, I assume you lived in the Phantom Ranger Station. Had it yet been segregated into an interpretive side of the building and a law enforcement side of the building?
Yeah, if I remember, I think I was only like one tour on once on the LE side, and then quickly moved into the west side.
Right.
Yeah, because the interpreters had left.
Okay, right. So this is November, and they would have left.
Yeah. So I was so that side was the volunteer side.
Yeah.
And there's three bedrooms, so I was in that that one little room. That's, it used to be a tool room or something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. And this was after the big remodel of the Phantom Ranger Station.
Way before. Yeah.
Okay. That's the one I remember, because when I started down here in 1975, that was still called the USGS house.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And it was pink.
Pink, yeah.
And the Rangers took it over as soon as I arrived. And I know there was a big remodel there, but you say you arrived still when it was in the old configuration.
Well, it depends. There might have been two.
There might have been two, right, exactly.
The one I know of has happened recently, like in 2010.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, anything memorable from those first days as you were learning about rangering down here? I mean,
Yeah, I think that was, it was funny. The two SAs, they got a lot of attention, and I didn't get any attention. And I couldn't figure out why. And then I realized that Dan Atroi thought that I knew everything.
Oh.
I mean, but I never worked here. I had gone through here a lot, you know. But I didn't know how they what they were doing, you know. So anyway, I started slowly learning everything, and one of my first projects was to get rid of the arundo. It was a tall grass that was brought here to make it looks like bamboo, so that people can make fishing poles. And there were clumps here and there. So my job was to dig it out. Yeah, so I did a lot of digging that out.
It's pretty hot right now, but there you go.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Helen's just brought us some tea here at the River Ranger Station.
Yeah, and so that was kind of, it was pretty neat. It was, you know, it was cold. I remember it being really cold.
Right.
And another thing they had me doing, there was a dam across the creek, a pretty big dam, but the beavers made, and below site 8.
Okay.
So one of my jobs was, they kept closing, the beavers kept closing this channel that the fish were, in those days, and nobody was against the trout.
Right.
They were into trout. And so they wanted me to keep opening this thing, this opening on the side of the, so the trout can come into the pool. And, but every night the beavers would shut it down. So every morning I had to pull it out. and that started this kind of beaver thing. And there was also, they were having trouble with the beavers. There was a channel that was taking water out of Lap Lake to the creek.
Oh, jeez.
And there was this channel, and they also kept closing that.
For those of you that don't know, the Lap Lake is the site of the former septic system that was located between the Phantom Ranger Station and the Fred Harvey Mule Corral. And it was sort of bad water.
Yeah.
And what Shores is talking about is this water running back into the creek.
Yeah, so the beavers would close up the water thing. So I was doing this, and after a while I said, you know, this is kind of ridiculous. Every morning in the cold, I'm sitting there doing that. So I kind of started watching what the beavers were up to.
Ah.
And so one of the things, and I kind of think of it in a science way.
Uh-huh.
So I tried different things. And then what I was doing, I was putting up sticks on their paths and to see and try to figure out when they knock those sticks down, they'll walk through there. So I did that for a while, some of this. And then I started realizing what was going on, that it was the, in the creek, it was the fact that the creek went down. And so it needed to stay up, whatever we did. So I said to Brian, we should make it like, you know, the Bonneville Dam, you know, on the Columbia River. They have a fish ladder. And so why can't we make a fish ladder? So Brian and me went in the water, and we made this fish ladder. And the fish started to come up the ladder. And then as soon as we got it finished, the fish were coming into the pond. And now the water didn't drop. And so the beavers never shut down that section, that channel. They just, you know, okay, the fish could climb up there. And it had a curve to the fish ladder. So it went up like this, and then went right to the top of the dam, and the fish can just go right up the ladder and into there. And now the creek stayed, the pond stayed the same level, so they never closed it.
That's interesting. I didn't know that Bright Angel Creek had a diurnal ebb to it, but it has a night and day ebb to it?
Just that pond, the beaver left the pond.
Oh, okay.
They kept damming it up, so the lake made a lake.
I see.
And then when I pull out the stuff, the lake would drop a foot.
Oh, okay.
And then they would fix it again. And this went every day, every night, this kept happening.
So in other words, you left the beaver pond at the same elevation, but provided a fish ladder for the fish.
Yeah, a fish ladder, and that way the lake could stay the same, the pond level, and they were happy with it, and the fish can go up.
So this is one of your first observations about the natural tendencies of an animal like the beaver.
Yeah.
And I assume that you probably got these observational skills from all your many years being a whale watcher, and then you just transferred those same skills to watching Phantom Ranch pretty closely.
Yeah. And then Lap Lake, with that channel there, was a similar situation, that the pond would go down and then they would close it. But there, we want the pond to go down because it was seeping onto the trail and making a big muck area on the trail. So there, what I did, I just got some welded wire and I bridged it over the channel. And then in front of the channel, in the pond, I rolled up some welded wire and made this thing where no matter how much stuff they put against it, the water will still get through and escape. That's how I solved that one.
And by the way, when he's referring to Lap Lake, that's spelled L-A-P-P and named after a former maintenance worker here, Howard Lap, who got his introduction to the park. I've just learned from doing this Phantom Ranch Centennial series for the Old Pioneer. Howard Lap started out as a private employee with the waterline construction in the mid-1960s and then eventually transferred to the Park Service. And Howard Lap was a big personality here at Grand Canyon. Mm-hmm. Did you know him? Or was he already gone?
Yeah, he was not down here.
But I
think he was still in the park.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, but Jerry Chavez is kind of a similar story. You know, he worked on the Trans Canyon Pipeline under Plateau Point.
Oh, he did. Oh.
Yeah, and then Larry Simskin talked him into applying for the job at Indy Gardens.
Okay. So who was the Inner Canyon supervisor at this time? Was it Dan Oltrogi?
Dan Oltrogi, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so.
Just trying to get a sense for who was on the staff here when you started.
Yeah.
And what other kind of natural history observations? I know you're a big weather geek. Did you take on to the weather observations at Phantom Ranch pretty early in your career?
Actually, that comes from my whale watching days.
Okay.
Yeah, because whales, how many whales you see is definitely determined how the weather is.
Yeah.
Because, you know, especially the Beaufort scale.
Right.
Yeah.
But is this a question of the ability to observe whales, or do they react differently to different weather? Or is it just that
both,
you don't see
actually,
the
spots? Both. Okay. Yeah, actually, yeah. But usually it has to do with observing whales.
Yeah.
Like if the water, the lake, or the ocean is completely flat, yeah. It looks like a glass, like a mirror, then you cannot see blows, you cannot see whale prints. You know, whales make prints behind themselves.
That's counterintuitive to me. I would think the blows would be easier to see when it's like glass.
No, because when it's like glass, it's like white, and so the prints are kind of glossy looking.
Right,
okay?
Right.
And so they disappear with the glossiness of the surrounding.
Huh.
Yeah, and then when blow is white and it's kind of a light color, the glassiness. So you don't see the blows so much. But what you do see is bodies popping up. Because they're dark, you see the bodies popping up. But once it goes to Beaufort 1 and 2, then the ocean turns, especially if it's blue sky, it turns ripply and it gets dark. Now you see blows and you see prints.
So Beaufort 1 or 2 is the ideal observation.
Yes, 1 and 2. And you can see whales that have light color underwater, under the surface.
Interesting.
Yeah. And then and then when it gets 3 or higher, then you get the other problem where the wind is blowing the blows too fast down. And there's a lot of whitecaps to compete with.
What do you remember about the levels of visitation in Bright Angel Campground when you first started as compared to today? If any difference?
Yeah, well, it's most of in the summer was the busiest months.
Right.
And you know, until P-Star started, but it was busiest month was when it was hot, and people were, which they still are afraid of the monsoon season because of rain, but which is we know is the ideal time to go. But yeah, and then in the winter time, there was a lot less people, and it wasn't unusual to have 5 nights in a row with nobody in the campground.
Nobody.
Yeah, nobody in the campground, and the ranch, same thing. The ranch was like normally, you know, they would have in the summer they would have 2 dinners.
Uh huh.
And then the canteen was open from 8 to 10, but then in the winter time, there wasn't enough dinner, so they made 1 dinner, and they had canteen hour from 7 to 9 instead.
Incredible.
Yeah, and that's not any close to that. Yeah.
Do you remember who the manager of the ranch was when you first?
Yeah, I can't remember her whole name. We call her Big Leslie.
Leslie Forster.
Yeah.
I know Leslie. Yeah. She's now working at the glamping site just near Valley.
Oh, really?
She's the manager of the glamping site. Helen and I got to go there this past summer and do training for their employees, and Leslie's still around.
Huh.
Yeah, she's always...
Because we also had little Leslie.
Yes.
Leslie Aldridge. Yeah.
Yes. Okay, yeah. Leslie Forster. And then, if I remember correctly, Warren Tracy arrived in 1990.
Uh-huh.
Very early in your career. Did you have good relations with Warren?
Yeah.
Okay. Excellent. And I understand you eat your dinners in the back with the Phantom Ranch employees.
Yeah.
How long has that been going on for?
It started, you know Alfredo and Sherry, right?
I know Alfredo and Sherry, yes.
Yeah, so Alfredo and Sherry, I'm the one who got them their job there.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and...
Were they down here as campers?
Yeah, they were here as campers. And... and that's a story in itself. It's so they came down here camping, and so I kind of got to know them in the campground.
So you didn't know them previously, but
yeah,
you met them.
Yeah, I didn't know them previously. And then...
Were they living in Prescott at the time?
No.
Okay.
And then they... and I can't remember which season it was, but they came back, and... Oh, I know. Then this next time they came back, it was springtime. So I think they came in the fall the first time.
Okay.
And then a few months later, they came back in the spring, and they had a permit to go see Shava Falls. Okay. And so anyway, we were talking, and then they told me that they had, because they had told me previously that they were going on a bicycle ride in Alaska or something, but that fell through. And so they came here instead, and they applied for a job with Fred Harvey on the rim. And I said, Fred Harvey, you know, on the rim? You don't want to work on the rim. So I ran over there and talked to Leslie and said, Leslie, there's some people in the camp. And I knew that Leslie needed a guy and a girl. So, And I said, they would fit perfectly. Perfectly, I told him. Well, send them over here. So I ran over there. I said, you got to, you have to set you up for an interview for a job. And they go, oh, no, we're on this hike. I said, no, it's not for the rim. It's for here at Phantom. Really? And so they went for an interview, and then they got invited for dinner. And then they end up hiking to Shava Falls. And then little Leslie, in those days, you know, everybody from the ranch took turns going to Shava Falls.
Yeah.
You know, it flowed almost every year. And so little Leslie went out there and ran into them, and they were talking. And Freda and Sherry told little Leslie, because she had to go back to work, that when if we got the job, can you put rock cairns at the trailhead over there at the junction at Clear Creek Trail? So she go, okay. So anyway, they came back, and there was no rock cairns. And they almost, because they were supposed to go to Cottonwood after that. So then they say, well, let's just go take a look. It's so close. So they come in, and little Leslie was one of the maids, and she was at the dorms. And so she comes out and says, you got the job.
Oh, and geez.
But they wanted to get it official from Leslie. And also I get this call over the radio with a guy named Ed Dunleavy. Yeah, so he was working here. And I said, I just saw Big Leslie heading for, she's hiking out. She's probably to the Black Bridge by now. And next thing I know, I see Alfredo Sherry running. And they run up there, and then she says to the fisher, yeah, you got a job here.
They just had to hear it from the horse's mouth.
Right, yeah. And so they came back, and then I run out and gave a big hug, and I said, welcome home.
For those of you that don't know, Alfredo and Sherry are a married couple. He's originally from Argentina. Not married, you're?
Yeah. He's from Mexico, and they're not married.
He's from Mexico? I thought he was from Argentina.
Yes. Depends what he says.
Oh, okay. Okay. Do you know their last names?
Alfredo Conde and Sherry... I can't think of it right now.
Okay. Well, this would have obviously been before Warren Tracy became the manager, so we're probably looking at early 1990 to 1989. And...
See that wasp? See, there's a wasp carrying that caliper, and then it's being chased...
By a lizard. I must admit that as we sit here and do these interviews in the Phantom Ranch area, you're always noticing when anything comes by, a moth is flying or a wasp carrying a big seed pod, or you're very observant of everything that's happening on the ground here. Yeah, so Alfredo and Sherry, that means that their association with Phantom Ranch goes back at least 32 years.
Yeah.
And right now, currently in 2022, they are not permanent employees, but they come down for a 10-day shift once a month.
Yeah.
And it's worked out very well during the COVID pandemic, just because they can fill in, and there's not a full cadre of employees now, but Alfredo and Sherry take up just one room. Any other big personalities from Phantom Ranch from your early days?
Yeah, well, after Fred and Sherry started here, then another person, a friend of theirs, John Wilkie. So because of them, John Wilkie started working here.
Okay.
And there are two other ones. Let's see, what was their name? But they live also in Prescott.
Yeah, there's quite a contingent of ranchers in Prescott now.
Yeah.
Well, I don't mean for you to recall everything from the early days, but I know one of the big projects that you have been very involved with, and something that's close to your heart, is the tree planting down here at Phantom Ranch, especially in Bright Angel Campground.
Yeah.
Tell us about that, you know, how you do these things from seed. And I think tomorrow what we're going to do with these interviews is we're going to go around with the recorder to all of the places where you have actually performed work.
Yeah, I can
and have you talk about things then.
Yeah, but yeah, basically I can show you that somebody can see what I did and do the same thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, so yeah, so when I first came here, it's I wasn't that involved, and I just did what everybody else did. The rangers work planting trees, so they were sending trees from the nursery up above and stuff like that. And so we did the first batch. Actually, we probably had finished planting the first stage of the trees by 93, and also started the screening thing because the beavers were chopping down so many trees.
Right, I remember when the screens went up.
Yeah, so they and everybody helped out in the screening of the trees. The interpreters, everybody was working on it, and it took a while to figure it out too, because when we first when we screened the first tree, that night the beaver got to the tree anyway. They had lifted the screen up, and then we had to. Then I came up with an idea of staking them down. And even then, they were able to pull the stakes out.
Jeez.
And so I came up with the idea of getting a rebar a foot and a half long, and then drill a hole on both ends and stick a nail in. So on the bottom end, it would make it like a hook, so it's more staked in. And then at the top, got some wire, wire to wire, and then banged it all the way down so that there was not even this much movement.
Oh.
And they also, even the first wire we had with the gauge was too small, and so the beavers could actually lean on it and start to push it around.
It was like chicken wire at first, wasn't it?
Well, we had welded wire. Yeah, I think we did start with chicken wire, actually what they call hardware cloth, and it didn't work. Okay? The beavers just worked it, and eventually come off. Yeah, and I think too that. We didn't get enough wire whoever was putting in this hardware cloth never got enough of it, and so it was very frustrating. So the wiring actually started before me, but with the welded wire that didn't work, and so I'm not sure how bad it was before, but apparently it was pretty bad. I later found documents of frustration. In the even in the months and weeks before I moved in, and so I came up with an idea that is that we use, and actually the ranch was using it before us, but that's what my idea came from, was let's use welded wire.
Yeah,
and then we experimented, so we did the gauge of the wire and then how we put it in and stuff like that.
Trial and error to make this work.
Yeah, trial and error, yeah. And then I think at the, when we were done, which took a couple years, we had protected 350 trees.
Nice.
Yeah, now, also part of the project was the ranch, because they did their own trees.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Yeah, so, yeah, a lot
But
of
you got involved with some of the ranch project?
I helped a little bit over there, and I also gave them trees over the years, you know.
Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah.
So the initial trees were from the nursery, and they were, you can carry them, they're in big pots and stuff like that. And, so those were cottonwood trees and some ash trees. Odd it may seem, but the ranch actually was the first to have the weld wire, and they also had already ash trees. We didn't.
Oh.
Yeah, and there was all the ash trees that were was done by a guy named Dennis Dorman, and who worked for the ranch up by the ranch.
Was he the maintenance man there?
He was a maintenance guy. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and then and Paul Liebel was here.
I remember
he
Paul.
Makes, he's a big part of how things worked here.
Oh, okay.
And
so there's a lot of cooperation between the what we used to call Fred Harvey employees, now Zantera, a lot of cooperation between them.
Yeah, and, well, yeah, a lot of times, well, especially, you know, like, I, you know, Paul would come down and help me sometimes, and sometimes I would help them. And Paul is the one who put the irrigation system for the ranch.
Okay.
Yeah, and so he, and he's, and that's like putting in not only the irrigation ditches were probably there already.
They were.
But he really fixed them, and then he put in the pipe system in the ground. And the campground, it's the campground, you know, was very similar. The campsites and everything, there hasn't been much change in that sense that on the ground, the ditches, those have not changed very much. But anyway, then we start, so when the trees got older, and I started learning more about trees. I started, and they were getting scared about all the cottonwoods, because the cottonwood, like Patty got hit with this cottonwood.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, and so it's visitors, but luckily nobody got hit seriously.
Yeah.
And, but it was, obviously the trees were getting older, and so that began the concern. So then I was told no more cottonwood trees.
Okay.
So then what I did is I started, I never got permission at first, but I started to germinate the seeds from the 93 trees, because they had grown and matured and was making viable seeds, a few of them. So I figured out which ones were viable, so I'd been collecting those seeds, and that's how I started. So making our trees are, you know, the ash trees that are growing now.
Okay. Yeah. What about hackberry and mesquite? Did you grow those?
I did a little bit of mesquite. They're actually fairly easy, but they're not big shade trees, you know. But they're really nice. So a lot of those trees I did germinate, but they also sent a batch of 70 mesquite trees. And so they sent the crew down, and me and the crew planted 70 trees in the campground, which is a lot of those trees. Not all of them, but a lot of those trees that are growing over the making the archway over the trail, that's those.
Yeah, I love those trees.
Yeah, and it's what makes the character of the campground, I think, is those mesquites, yeah.
If we could just make a time out here, I understand that there's going to be a reconfiguration of the campground. Are they going to reposition trails or campsites or drainage ditches?
Yeah, I'm not the person to ask, because I'm not part of the planning at all. I just hear these rumors, and that's all they are.
Oh, they're just rumors. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, there might be some fact to it, but
right.
I don't know what to say, because I haven't seen anything.
What do you think is the impetus for changing the layout of the campground? I mean, it seems pretty established to me. Is it...
Yeah, I
what do you hear from rangers about the need for it?
Well, I think, I'm not sure where it all is coming from, but I know that there is a concern about the rock falls.
Oh, yeah, right.
Yeah,
right.
And so I think there's but I don't know what the plan is.
Right.
That they want to move the sites a little bit forward from the cliff.
Yeah, okay.
So what that involves, that I don't know.
Well, that makes sense, at least in terms of why it's happening. But,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so they... So a lot of those ash trees that you see in the campground that are probably 10 feet and smaller, I germinated here.
Wow.
In the backyard. And so another thing we'll go through, I'll go through that. That way I like this, people get an idea how it made it work.
Well, I think tomorrow we're going to do an on-site tour, probably from the north end of Phantom Ranch all the way down to the Black Bridge, and we can... We can talk about some things then.
Yeah.
But I did want you to be able to talk about that, because I know it's really important to you that after you leave, that this tree project and this tree love and concern continues with the ranchers that are here.
Yeah.
Do you plan to write down sort of a maintenance schedule, or like when to turn on the water in the spring and when to turn it off in the fall? I mean...
Yeah, it's... The problem is that I can kind of do something like that, but the problem is that what I notice is that you have to look at trees as individuals.
Okay.
So you got one tree, for some reason, it's not growing fast, give it more care. Another tree is growing fast, you give it less care. You know what I mean?
Okay.
And you kind of have that, but of course, The only way somebody can do that is do what I did, that I keep an eye on them, you know.
Do you have individual names for any trees?
I started that at first, but then I stopped. Yeah, in fact,
I figured you would.
Yeah, like we actually have a Warren and a Lane tree, but I can't remember which one is which one now.
Okay. Well, they're a married couple, so that's okay that it's one or the other. Oh, cool.
Yeah.
We briefly touched on the weather station. I know that when I was guiding trips down here, I would always go to you to find out what the temperature was last night and what the temperature was yesterday. I tend to be more interested in what the weather was, uh-huh. although I can say that I'm equally interested in what it's going to be. But
yeah.
When you first started, I guess it was still a manual weather station?
Yeah, and when I got here, the weather station was over there by the Packer House.
Yes.
Now everybody calls it Jerome's place. And it was in front, yeah, in front there.
The original USGS house.
Yeah,
that I walked over there today, and that station is still there. But where's the official station now? It's at the Ranger Station.
Yes, it's not in the backyard. It's outside the backyard.
Okay.
There's two of them, actually.
Oh.
One is automated, and you can actually see the numbers real time on the internet, but it's not as accurate.
Okay.
And the old one is farther back, and that's the one we take. That one's much more reliable and it's
more
accurate.
Oh, so you still actually do a manual recording?
Yeah.
Are they the same kind of sheets I did in the 1970s?
It's on the computer.
It's on the computer.
We still have the sheets.
Yeah.
So we write it on the sheet because sometimes, and the day, especially summertime, is when we get real busy.
Yeah.
With the medical, so sometimes we can do it, write it down real quickly. And then later on, get on the computer or the computer down. When it comes out, we can put it in.
And what other things have interested you down here besides the trees and the weather? I know I've seen you working with condors a lot.
Yeah. So I go up there.
Yeah.
And
just on the Clear Creek Trail.
On a ridge that's going this way, and I'll monitor condors. I do that like twice a week in the wintertime only.
Twice a week in the wintertime only.
Yeah.
Tell us some of the things you found in the last year about the condors. Are you seeing them every day in the winter, or are they...
Well, in the summer, there are more of them.
There's more of them.
But they tend to fly the upper third and along the rim. And then when winter, and then in wintertime, most of them leave, but a few do stay, generally the nesting pairs.
Oh.
Yeah, and then they seem to fly mostly in the middle third.
What do you mean middle third? You mean of the canyon?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so more like the red wall.
So you can actually tell at what level of the Grand Canyon they're flying in with your little device?
Well, if I visually see them.
Oh, if you visually see them. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So in the summertime, they're up near the rim, and then in the wintertime, they come down to the level of the red wall.
Yeah.
Do they ever come in the inner canyon at all?
Not as much. They can. Yeah. I've seen them down here, but not as much as they used to.
Okay.
Yeah. When they first came, I started seeing. So that would be in the 90s.
Mid-90s.
And I didn't even have the telemetry. I mean, the people had them, but I didn't have one.
Right.
And I used to go up there. We did have condors that came deeper into the canyon and even land at Phantom. Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. We had a couple that was always landing here and stuff. And then, even though I wasn't doing the officially, I would, like, notify Peregrine Fund if there was something different. But I remember one time that there was a couple here. They used to hang out above on a tree above number 10, cabin 10. And they flew to the release site within an hour.
Holy cow.
Yeah, but I think that they went up this way, you know, because they just probably went up the canyon and
up Red Angel
and then
Canyon.
Come down in House Rock. So then it's really not that far.
It's not that far. It's it's just amazing to think because if you want to go from Phantom Ranch to the release site, you know, you're looking at a full day.
Yeah. But one of the things that I find interesting is the changes. Look.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, two condors.
Flying right over your observation place.
Yeah. That's funny, we're talking about condors. There's two of them flying there.
They're flying to the west?
Oh, a third one.
You see a third? Oh, yeah, there it is.
You know what it is? It's probably our family unit.
Is that one of the offspring that's flying with the two adults?
Probably. Yeah, because it's if you see right now, it's most likely they're an identity. Let's see if I can get the... I wonder if there's a binocular in here.
So, we're sitting here talking about condors, and Shores has just noticed three California condors coming in from the east, back behind or north of Sumner Butte. And he's gone to get some binoculars in the River Ranger Station. And they seem to be on a mission. They have headed west out of sight, but we might see them again. I'm just going to pause the recording here for a second. And what numbers is the family unit?
So he would be 423.
423.
And she's 521. And he's 1114.
Oh, they've got four digits now? They're up to four digits.
Yeah, four digits, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, so when they first came they were like two, they're like 2-year-olds. And they were kind of knuckleheads, and they kind of started gathering together and becoming a gang. Yeah, they were kind of like a gang, and then they would fly around, and they would like land at the tip-off, and they would start tearing up the bathrooms and stuff. And twice, Peregrine called me, and I had to run up to the tip-off to chase these. The gang of 18 out of there.
I think you passed me on the trail one time. You were just charging up there. I remember they used to land at Plateau Point, too, and land on the railing.
Yeah, and so that's why they put all those spikes on all the buildings and stuff.
Right.
But once they got older, they started mellowing out, and it never happened again. And I think it's because now there's adults.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so they're not doing the gang thing anymore, but... Yeah, that was a really interesting time.
I remember one other interesting bird that used to be at Phantom Ranch, and I don't know if it was before your time or during, but that was the North American turkey named Kathy.
Oh, yeah, I was here for Kathy.
Talk about Kathy. She was here for many years.
Yeah. Yeah, Kathy was, Kathy was a mellow, generally. Yeah, it was a mellow turkey, because then, we got two other turkeys later.
Yeah.
And they
they didn't get names, did they?
Yeah, they got names. It was Mark and Bill.
Mark and Bill.
Named after you know who.
Well, I can guess Bill. Is it 1L Bill?
Yeah.
And Mark Yeston?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty funny. And
whatever happened to Kathy?
Well, we think, and I'm pretty sure, so Bill found, there was this weird thing where Kathy was here most of the time, and then she started, but in the springtime, she would disappear for a while. And then sometimes we would see her running to her phantom down the North Kaibab Trail. So we think she was doing something up there. We never did figure out what it was, for like 6 weeks.
Oh.
But then she changed her behavior later on. And
you still call her a she, I see. Even though you know she was a male.
It wasn't a male?
I don't know. I thought you said Kathy was a male.
No, she was it was a she.
It was a she. Okay, yeah, I misunderstood you. Yeah. I'm sorry.
Yeah, and then she started going up across the bridge.
You're kidding. The Silver Bridge?
And went to Indian Gardens. So we're never sure if she walked across the bridge or she flew.
Right.
Because we've seen her do both.
Oh, you actually saw her.
Yeah, yeah. And so anyway, she headed to Indian Garden and spent some time there. And then around Thanksgiving, she showed back up. And this went on for a while. And she even one time showed up on Thanksgiving Day and stood on the tables outside the cantina while the turkey dinner was happening. and people were like, looking out the window like, well, they're eating their turkey. Yeah, that was pretty...
Did she just disappear, or was she found...
She was... There was a... So she was at Indian Gardens, and she actually kind of hooked up with... there were two males hanging out there. And then, and one time she even laid eggs. And I seen the eggs.
Wow.
Yeah, and, but then something looked like got to her eggs. Eventually, she vanished, and then Bill Van Graaff found a turkey carcass that was really eaten on in one of those side canyons to the east of Indian Gardens.
Oh.
So we think she, that was her.
Oh.
Yeah.
Maybe a fox?
Could be. We don't know.
Have you seen coyotes down here?
No.
Yeah, there aren't coyotes in the Grand Canyon.
I've never seen a coyote or a rabbit.
Or a rabbit.
Yeah. Huh. But I have seen rabbits in like in the Thunder River area.
Yeah.
On the Esplanade, but never here.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, but yeah, so...
What's the most unusual natural bird you've seen come through the ranch? I know you're an observer of birds, and I know you look at birds. I mean, what are some of the accidentals you've seen?
I think the most rare bird was actually found by a rancher named Bill Holman, and he came right into the front of the ranger station, and he was all excited. Charles, I need a witness. And we went down to the corral, and it was a...
Fred Harvey Corral.
Yeah, Fred Harvey Corral. It was a painted bunting.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and so they're multicolor. And that, in fact, that's the only painted bunting I've ever seen in my life. Yeah.
What would be their closest range that would not be weird for them? Are they a tropical bird? Are they a...
Yeah, I don't even know what their range is.
Okay.
I never seen one before.
I know when I was working down here, the packer's name was Stan Stockton, and he came into the River Ranger Station just all a flutter. He had seen a purple gallinule down by the river, and that was a total accidental. It's the only time a purple gallinule has been seen in Grand Canyon National Park. Any other birds besides the painted bunting?
Well, they we used to have that that eagle, that bald eagle that was here for 19 years.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, I wasn't aware of that.
Yeah, so I first saw him, or her, I don't know, and at Pipe Creek. And it was immature.
On the ground?
Yeah, it was on the ground, and sometimes we at Pipe Creek trying to get fish or cross the Pipe Creek, you know, on the side of the river, a flyover.
Uh-huh.
And it was there. And then on the, like, on the second, I guess on the third year, it started getting the white head.
Okay.
And so
was
I
it
figured,
a year-round resident?
No, just winter.
Okay.
Just winter. But most of the winter. And then it started hanging out over here. And then we had what we called the Eagle Tree. And that was a tree that was right above those benches there by the Troker bunkhouse.
Uh-huh.
And it was sit up a tree. And then it had a couple other favorite trees. But sometimes it would be adjacent from the Troker, not Troker, but the Ranch's bunkhouse. And I would see it out the window. And then it would go down. And, of course, those days there was a lot of trout. And then I would run through the ranger station, and then I'd see it come out with the fish and land on the eagle tree and eat it.
Jeez.
Yeah, so anyway, it was here for 19 years in a row, and then finally didn't come back. So I figured that, you know, it's usually 4 years when they finally get the white head. So when I first saw it, I think it must probably was just guessing 2 years. So it was probably 21 years old.
And that's probably the natural lifespan for a wild eagle.
Yeah. Yeah, so that was kind of neat having that around.
Never got banded or radio collared or anything?
No, I never saw any bands on or anything. Yeah. I don't know where it went for the summer, but it would show up in the days around Thanksgiving.
Oh.
Yeah. And one of my jobs is, because of the way the ranger station was, we had the kitchen out there in that front of that window. So I'd be, you know, whatever, having breakfast there, and all of a sudden I see the eagle come flying in and land on this tree. And then my job was to call Warren at the ranch and said, the eagle has landed. Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah. Yeah, that was pretty neat to have that. Have your personal eagle down here. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I also seen the eagle and the condors have some contact with each other. Yeah.
Are they simpatico or?
Was that?
Were they simpatico? Did they like each other, or did they just check each other out?
Yeah. Well, the one incident was we had a condor 122. And 122 is a special bird because his father was the last of the 22 condors to be removed from the wild.
Oh.
Yeah, and so 122, N119, that was his mate, and they also, they're the first to use that one cave that there's been now four couples have been in that same cave.
In Salt Creek?
In the Horn Creek.
Horn Creek.
Yeah, by the battleship.
Yeah.
But he was around with his mate, flying around, and the eagle had just caught the fish, still had his fish in his talons, and the 122 charged it and knocked him off his branch, and he took over the branch.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, which kind of probably was a bad move, and I think he couldn't do anything with his talons in the fish, but that could have been the last move.
Wow. Yeah.
But he did something like that to me, too. I was up on the flats, and they came by, both of them.
Utah flats.
I used to watch condors at the very south point of Utah flats, and then they flew around me, and then, you know, they can almost turn their neck and look back. So he'll fly by and kept turning his neck and looking back at me. Then he'll fly around and do the same thing over and over and over. And then I finally said, you know, I better sit down. And so I sat down, and it swooped down right over me.
Wow.
Yeah, so he was kind of a mean guy. Like, he would, like, at a carcass, he would, like, chase the other condors away. And he would eat first, then he would let his mate eat second, and then he finally let everybody else eat.
Wow.
Yeah.
Cool. The night sky is also very important to you?
Yeah, I do a lot of night sky stuff, yeah.
Were you involved with refurbishing a lot of the lighting down here? Or?
Well, it was more other people did, but I'm the one who probably said a lot most about it, because I've been saying things, we need to get dark skies. So, yeah, I'm probably one of the bigger pushers for it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that a lot of that was just having blinds on the windows in the buildings.
Blinds, yeah. And then you probably noticed all the red lights now we have.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I think as early as the 70s when I was here, those lights that are in the public areas of the Phantom Ranch area, they had shields on them even back then. They weren't just light bulbs out on a pole.
Yeah.
Even back in the 70s, they had shields on them, but...
Yeah, so what happened to them?
Were they gone?
Well, yeah, by the time I got here, they were... It was just the disc, and the other shield was gone.
Oh.
Yeah, so you look right into the raw bulb, and I'm not quite sure. So that was like that when I got here. But some did have shields, but some looked like they took the shield off, and just the disc on top was showing.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and the disc was white inside, so it just made it even worse. Yeah.
Well, when I was here in the 70s, all of those lights there in the public areas of Phantom Ranch were yellow bulbs. They weren't, they were bug lights.
Yeah, they had yellow. I remember they were yellow when I got here, though.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there was some kind of awareness even before the word dark sky had been invented for some reason. It probably was because of the bugs.
Yeah. I remember too when I made my first two hikes here, that the ranch had a zapper.
Yes, I was just gonna bring that up. Yeah. I was just gonna bring that up.
Yeah.
And that zapper lasted a couple of seasons, and then I believe it was Pam Cox, who you will remember was a big bat person, and knew that bats love bugs, and just it might have been Pam who said this isn't right, and the zapper left.
Yeah, so the, and then the canteen wasn't open during the day. You had to buy everything out the side window.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, when I first moved here in 75, a can of beer was $2.25, and that was expensive.
Yeah. And then they had a beer machine, didn't they?
They did in the employee area. Yeah. I don't know if they had a beer machine for the public.
So this would be before my time. I heard that they had a beer machine for the public.
Oh.
But then later on, they had to put a stop to that, and that beer machine went into their housing.
Okay.
And it was a refrigerator for their fridge. So that, right. So that was already had happened when I got here.
Yeah.
But then.
So, tell me about Pam Cox.
I haven't heard from her for a while.
Well, I just heard from her.
Oh, yeah?
Because I'm trying to track her down to write an article about, I think she was here for 10 years. 10 or 12
probably
years.
Probably something like that, yeah.
And in my mind, I thought she was the first interpretive ranger. But it sounds like there were interpretive rangers here before Pam, speaking to you earlier.
And before me, there were interpreters.
Yeah.
Well,
Pam would have been the first person that I listened to a talk from. So I got really enamored with the idea of rangers being here whose only job was to share the beauty and the wonder of the Grand Canyon with the visiting public. So, to me, Pam looms very large in my brain, but I guess there were other interpreters that were here.
Yeah.
Well, this is just such great information that you've shared with us, and I know that tonight, when we break, you can think about other things you want to talk about tomorrow, but what do you think? You want to keep going, or is that enough for today?
What time is it?
What time is it?
It's not quite 4:30 yet.
4:30, so
maybe another 20 minutes, half an hour.
Yeah, and you know, I try to bring up questions to ask you. Maybe there's things you want to talk about that I'm not thinking about.
Let's see. How about predicting flash floods?
Yes, predicting flash floods. You've seen a few, I guess.
Yeah, so I've seen a few of them. What I have, I was doing weather even when I was doing, before I even came here, so weather always kind of became a hobby of mine. And so when we were getting these flash floods, I started, trying to figure it out. And so, so every summer, as we know, that we have this time where we get these hard, like these squalls that pour really hard and sometimes, and not that many times, it may cause a flash flood. And so I tried to see if I figured it out. And so the first thing I noticed that the only part of the sky that you really have to worry about down here at concerning Bright Angel Creek is the north sky. So in the direction of where the North Star is. And that's where you watch. And
just to be clear, where the North Star is would be on the west side of Bright Angel Creek. Kind of between Phantom Creek and Bright Angel Creek.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's the part of the sky you're talking about.
Yeah, and so the, now that we have technology that we can get on the internet, you can look at the radar thing. Like I use Weather Underground, the telecast.
Uh-huh.
And they have where it's kind of like maybe 50 minutes old or less. And you can watch. And so the things that were, of course, in the morning, there's hardly any clouds. But usually there's enough clouds that you can get an idea of what direction they're going that day. Yeah, usually it's just somewhere from the south or southwest or southeast. But it doesn't matter what direction, but if wherever the direction, and then kind of get an idea how fast they're going, because most of the time, they're moving too fast, and so even though it could be an intense thunderstorm, it lasts 20 minutes and it's over.
Right.
And so nothing happens. So that's what I do in the morning. And then the other one I can do too is I'll check the weather station at the airport. So you can get on there. And
Grand Canyon Airport?
Yeah, Grand Canyon Airport. And there I will check to see what the humidity level is in the morning at daybreak. And so what happens is the humidity seems to drop to the ground level in the night. And then when you before the sun hits the ground, get that to thing. So what is the lowest in the morning hours? What is the highest humidity? And then watch. And as soon as the sun hits the ground, you'll see the humidity starts dropping. And what it's really doing is going up.
Right.
And so, but at least you know you've got 70% of humidity. If it's below 70%, most likely it will not rain at Phantom. Now, it may rain on the rims, but it most likely will not rain at Phantom. If it's if it is above 70% and a cloud happens to go over Phantom and then starts dropping it, it could hit Phantom. So that's one thing I had noticed.
Okay.
Yeah. But anyway, concerning with the flash flood, so then whatever I'm doing something, and if I start seeing the clouds, you know, I know that the clouds are moving slow today, so I kind of look in that area. And if I see a dark cloud and I hear boom, 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 and okay, and it's been there for a while, then I'll look. And what I find that what people are mistaking is that they're trying to predict before something happens. It doesn't work. You have to know what happened, and then you make your predictions. So you want to know that it's actually rain there. And usually I can call North Rim. You know, a lot of times they'll call us, oh, it's raining really hard. That doesn't mean anything to me. To me is, I want to know how many inches it rained. Call me up when there's 2 inches of rain in 1 hour. Because you need to have
a certain... Can they get that much rain in 1 hour?
Yeah. That's what causes our flash floods.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And if it's lower than that, then it's almost nothing. So I've been able to predict everything under, below, above 4 feet. Okay. So if they say that, then I'll start doing something, you know, pulling the irrigation tubes out and go along the creek and get everybody out and tell everybody else to stay away from the creek. The other one is, you can also have it where it just hits the phantom drainages. And of course, that's not going to show up on the rim there, but that could cost you too. Get on the radar, see how fast it's moving. If it's green, don't worry about it. If it's yellow, don't worry about it. If it's red, shows red, and it's moving very slow, now you have to start worrying about it. Yeah, and then...
And you watch your watch and see how long it hangs out.
Yeah, and then you call the North Rim, how much you get it. And then I also see where the rain is falling and which drainages, you know. Like this last one we had in August, it hit both sides of Bright Angel.
That's right. A lot of it came out of that stream on the east side near Hatton Butte.
Yeah. And the cue is how much rain in a short period of time. Because if it's like you get 2 inches of rain in 4 hours, it's not going to happen.
And you mentioned the 4 foot level above or below. Where do you measure how many feet it is above?
I use the bridge, the upper campground bridge.
The upper campground bridge, the one that carries the sewer line.
Yeah, carries the sewer line. And that, so that way you're measuring from the same place.
Right,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that's the best way to predict it. The other one is we had last summer, we had issues that every time we started getting rain, our internet went out. So we couldn't look what was happening. So this was on August 17th. But something was up. And so even that morning, I was already telling people to keep their eye on that part of the sky. And if it's you see dark over there, make sure that you're facing upstream and get ready to run. And then don't go there at night. Don't go to the creek at night. And so I had been telling everybody throughout the thing. But then when I did the campground check, I saw funny things going on, but I couldn't tell exactly what was going on. And then when I went after I did the campground check, I went to the internet, and the internet was not working. And so this one summer snuck up on me. So I had warned everybody, but it did sneak up. It wasn't like what I before, I know it's coming. So that's the first one time I didn't get it forecasted. But that was 7 feet.
August 17th was 7 feet?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That big debris flow that came out of that side drainage was impressive.
Yeah, it was very impressive because that used to be a drop-off there.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's gone.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was crazy. So that was two sources. Yeah. Yeah, there was a little bit of panic in the campground, and it was roaring.
Have you ever spoken to anybody in all your years here who witnessed the 1966 flood?
No. Yeah, I missed the 1995 flood, that where the girls got stuck on the island.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I was actually in Hawaii watching whales, and a flood came.
You're talking about the island in the Colorado River just downstream from the Silver Bridge?
No, this one over here.
The one on Bright Angel Creek.
Yeah, that split.
Oh, yeah, that one.
Yeah, I wasn't here for that, but I was in Hawaii doing whale stuff, and a big storm came in, and I had just walked away from my campsite and to go to the restroom, and I came back, and it had gone by, and it was like, the creek bed. I was camped right here on the edge, and the water had gone right to there. And then I was able to grab my bicycle and my tent before it crested over that. And it didn't, actually. But I wasn't sure if the land would start falling away or what.
This is in Hawaii.
In Hawaii. And 2 days later, it came here and did that.
Wow.
And that was a 9-footer. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So that was a winter flood, so it wasn't a flash flood, so it rose over hours.
And wasn't that the flood where the creek was actually in two channels for a number of years? Or was that a different flood that I'm thinking about?
Since I've been here, I don't remember it going to two. It split in two, but soon the water went down and went back to one.
I think there was a short time in the 1980s before you started working here where that eastern channel actually had water for a year or two.
Yeah. Yeah, when I first came here, there was a big berm that kept the creek going this way. And the 95 flood broke through it.
Yeah.
And because the girls actually was on that berm, and they went to the creek, and they actually saw water on the other side, but didn't think anything of it. And then it broke through right behind them, like 10 minutes after they
arrived. How long were they stranded on the island?
Overnight.
Overnight?
Yeah.
Holy cow.
But you got to... Now, Brian, Brian was here for that.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Brian Wisher.
Brian was here, and... Well, he was up at Indian Garden, but Brian and Jerry Chavez came down to help. Yeah.
Did they throw him some gear?
Yeah, they went on this side, and they threw a rope, or first I guess a string, and then with a rope attached, and then brought a radio over, and then communicated with them, and then they started bringing stuff in. But meanwhile, the North Rim had said that the rain had stopped and it's snowing, and so they should be starting to go down then.
Wow.
Yeah, and it's funny because, remember Sandy Han? She was a ranger here.
Yeah, I do remember Sandy. I can't picture her, but I...
She had this idea to make a trail from the boat beach to the confluence.
Uh-huh.
And I said, no, you can't do that. And she goes, why not? And because they won't stay there. So I showed her pictures before the 1966 flood where the creek had split then. So it was split before the 66 flood. So whatever you put there, it's not going to stay. So, that's a bad idea. And so that conversation was just several months before I was in Hawaii.
Wow.
And then, so when I came back from Hawaii, I was in L.A., and I was at my parents' house in L.A., and I called up Brian, and we had a flash flood, and the girls got stuck on an island. I said, let me guess. You had a flood, and then the girls wanted to go watch the flood at the confluence, and they got cut off when the creek split. Because how do you figure that one out? Because I had a feeling that was what it was, because I'd seen pictures, old pictures.
Wow.
Before the 96 flood, they had done that then. Yeah.
You know, another big personality down here is Bill Vandergraff.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he started in 1990. Would have been shortly after you were here, or?
I don't know.
He used to work at the airport, but then he...
He worked at the airport, and then he was volunteering for the backcountry office.
Okay.
Yeah. Then it was the borough. Yeah.
Well, I know you said you didn't want to talk about politics or anything, and that's fine. I just thinking of, you know, famous people that have been Phantom Rangers, and just wondered if you had any stories about Bill and his time down here. You know, trying to block out his more recent feelings about the Park Service and things, but just, you know, Bill's a big Grand Canyon personality.
Yeah, yeah. Well, he, you know, Bill had this thing where when we'd have searches, you know, and I think that you don't see that much like that anymore, but Bill had this thing where while the people were searching, like he was down here during a big search that was something that was the Surprise Valley area, and he found out that this guy that was missing had connection to Flagstaff, and then he would like go around, he would like try to, you know, and that he was a climber, so he would contact the climbers that he knew and try to find somebody who knew this guy. He would go to the ranch. He was really good investigating when there were searches and things. And he was really good at that. And in fact, I would say he's probably one of the best I've seen, you know. Of course, I'm never, you know, with the people who are doing those investigations, but this is the one I was, he would really find things. Then he would even get the book open, you know, Death in the Grand Canyon, find incidents of what happened to people in Surprise Valley, in that area, what happened to them and stuff. He was really good in figuring that out, because that's what you should do, right?
That's interesting. I just, when Helen and I checked in here last night, I saw the book, The Last Season, about a backcountry ranger in Sequoia Kings Canyon. And they were talking about the protocols that have been developed for search and rescue.
Uh-huh.
And it sounds like maybe Bill was at least aware of some of these things on how you set up a search and rescue and all the different things that you don't overlap duties and you don't neglect some duties.
Yeah, but he was assigned to investigate,
information on the lost person.
It isn't just calling the parents and the family. You got to start reaching out, especially if the Flagstaff, there's the whole community that hikes here.
Yeah.
You know?
Huh. Cool. Yeah, and he did a lot of backcountry patrols.
Uh-huh, yeah.
Did you ever do backcountry patrols?
Somewhat. But more around this area. Yeah.
Like maybe over to Clear Creek?
Yeah. Most of my hiking was on my own time. Okay. Yeah.
Have you been to Haunted Canyon?
Oh, yeah, many times. Yeah.
Many times?
Yeah. Yeah, in fact, I've done 2 rescues there.
Oh?
Yeah. There was not enough space in the helicopter, so I had to walk back.
Oh, so you got flown into
it? Flown in there, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I understand that it's heavily overgrown and it's kind of unpleasant to walk up in there now.
Well, it depends. It grows real thick in there, really thick. I've been there so thick. It's like it took me...
What is it, Baccharis?
Yeah, it's all kinds of stuff. It's just thick.
Yeah.
Baccharis.
That's what I've heard.
Yeah, so Baccharis and, also other things. But just, and it just to go that short distance from the, you know, from the main canyon to, you know, to up on to the next first drainage, take you like 2 hours. And so a lot of times you couldn't even be on the bottom. You had to go back up on the bench.
Yeah.
And then other times, completely clear.
Wow.
Completely. And as the flash floods, wipes it all out.
Huh.
Yeah, so I've seen it both ways. And it's weird because, you know, I go back there, I don't want to go there, and also I go, what happened here? It's all open. Yeah.
Did you ever go to the spot where the hippie camp was?
Yeah. Yeah, I've been up at the hippie camp, and then I've been out to what I call the Outlet Canyon. And it heads straight north.
To the outlet, which is a feature on the north rim.
Yeah, there's a choke stone, and you can get around the choke stone, and you go all the way, and then finally you get to the end where the red wall comes and pinches out, and you can kind of go in.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that's pretty nice in there.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've never made it to Haunted Canyon, I started working down here about, it was less than 12 months after the hippie camp had been raided. And Phil Hecker, who was the ranger, the head guy when I was here, he talked about the hippie camp. And I guess they were growing food there. And
yeah, I don't know too much. I see things there. I see a bench there and some antlers and things. There was one of the wranglers here. You might know him, Bud.
Oh, yeah. Rippey?
Yeah. And he, so his name Bud Rippey? I can't remember what his last name was.
Well, Bud Rippey was a wrangler here in the 70s and early 80s.
Yeah, and he was also sheriff.
I think so.
Yeah, he was sheriff, yeah. So when he was a sheriff, he was helped get rid of those hippies back there. so that's... Ross Knox is his son-in-law.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and Patty Knox is his daughter.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, he's also was the first on scene after that plane, the two planes crashed. Over there by Quaggint and all that play where the two...
Airliners?
Yeah, the airliners.
In 1956?
Yeah, he was involved there.
Holy cow.
He was also involved with that priest. Where the priest... Oh,
down
the two
in
boys.
Tanner?
Yeah, Tanner.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, we have sat down and talked about things. Yeah, it was kind of...
Well, we might not be talking about the same person. Although Bud Rippey was a wrangler in 1975, 76, and 77.
Yeah, I
just
know
that's not that far removed from the priest and not that far removed from the aircraft.
Yeah, I don't know what his last name was, but it was Bud.
Uh-huh.
And he would ski. He'd go skiing and...
Huh.
Yeah. But yeah, he used to come down here. I think his name was Bud Dunnigan.
Okay, so it is a different Bud.
Yeah, Bud Dunnigan, that was his name, yeah.
Okay, well, I'm glad you remembered that to clear things up.
Yeah, so he quit working as a wrangler when he took out a trip out to Pato Point, and he was already pretty old then, and his rider disappeared. They were at Plateau Point. They were away from the mules, and all of a sudden this woman was missing, and Brian Wisher was at Indian Gardens, and he ran around below there and found her, and the turkey vulture found her first.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah. Yeah, Dunnigan. That was his name, Ed Dunnigan.
Did you get a chance to go down the river in your volunteer years here?
Yeah, so after I started volunteering here, I think that one time I got to go on the river and I was still on the North Rim. And I got to do the bottom half.
Okay.
Yeah. And then later on, when I was here, so Kate Abram...
Uh-huh.
Came up to me and she wanted me to do that same thing I did at Hans.
Oh.
But there was something different, and that was that we had to hike in, okay, in the middle of the summer. And I said, I'm not sure I want to be hiking, you know, a bunch of food and everything in the middle of the summer.
And Hans is a hard trail.
Yeah, but this was, they wanted me to go to Crystal.
To Crystal, okay.
Yeah. And I said, no. But anyway, so they did the project, and apparently they had to medevac several people from the project because they had hiked in and got in trouble. And so then she came back to me. She said, we'll raft you in to Crystal. And there was one of the ranchers, her name was Michelle. We were planning to go on her birthday. We were going to go to... We're going to hike out the north side and go to Bryce. And I had my car parked already over there. And I said, well, I already have plans unless I can bring somebody along. And so she goes, okay, yeah, you can bring somebody along. So I went up to Michelle. Michelle, hey, I got a different birthday present for you. a river trip. So we went on the river. So we went down river, and a Tour West picked us up. And that's the first time I've ever been on a motorboat.
Uh-huh.
And those, you know, they're kind of strange boats.
Tour West has the strange ones.
Yeah. Yeah, I call them the Klingon ships.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then so we got dropped at Crystal, and then we spent like 3 or 4 days there. And we're doing the same thing I was doing before. And that's where I met Tom Martin. He came on a river trip, and I met Tom Martin for the first time.
Okay.
Yeah, and then, so we were there 3 or 4 days, and then another boat came and picked us up from the Park Service. And we went all the way to Diamond, and we started taking the boats and cars. You know how the beach there, the creek is on one end of the beach?
Yeah.
So we took the boat apart, and he wanted to leave quick. He didn't want to stick around, the boatman. And so it was only four of us. And then we took it apart, and then it was a snout boat. That's what it was, like 21 feet. And then after we took it apart, we walked to the creek, and I look, and there's no road. And I go, holy shit, the whole road is gone. It's been flashed out. So I yell, hey, I think you better take a look. And we took a look, and sure enough, the whole thing was flashed away. And I went up canyon to see how far it went, and we went right down the road, the canyon where the road came out of. So there was a truck wasn't coming. So we had to put it back together.
Oh, geez.
Put it back together.
Re-rig,
yeah. And then luckily some big boats arrived, and they had the vacuum cleaner looking thing. And so pumped us up. And then we ran into Mike McGinnis, and he told us about where some gas was, because we didn't have enough gas to go to the end. But we ended up going to the end, So that was neat for me because, that was, to get to see that last part and to see how it ends. The way it ends is just total. I never thought it would end just like that. Yeah.
Just like that?
Yeah. Yeah, and then we hooked up with Hatch, too, and they helped get us through. And we got stuck in the sand a couple times with all the sand there.
Yeah.
Yeah. But that was neat to be able to go all the way to the end, see the complete.
You know, we're sitting here on the south side of the River Ranger Station, and I remember the story of one of the Phantom Rangers who had a hot tub here. And I think maybe we're in the location where the hot tub was.
Yeah. Yeah, it was.
Just right there against the rocks.
Yeah.
Interesting story.
Yeah. But the only part I will tell you about that was I had nothing to do with it.
Yeah, we want to make that clear. This was not your hot tub, and you never sat in the hot tub.
I never sat in the hot tub, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Well, you can go ahead and...
Yeah. But I did get... I had to go up to the rim to be, you could call it, interrogated. And...
a material witness.
Yeah, and so they asked me the question. Of course, I didn't know anything. I never came down to do that. And But then they took our hard drive, and in the hard drive there was a picture of me and Jerome, and it was actually there were two pictures. One picture was two Phantom Ranchers in uniform, standing there like there was that those three girls, our Charlie Angels. They were standing like Charlie Angels. But they go, where was this picture posted? And I said, well, it was posted at the back of the ranch where the employees eat. So it wasn't, the public couldn't see. Oh, no, the public couldn't see it. So that was okay.
Yeah.
And then she pulls out a picture of me. So when I'm talking to her, I have this huge beard. Okay. And also she pulls out this picture, and it's a picture of Jerome and I in Halloween costumes. And Jerome was in what I call the Tonga. He looked like Tonga guy, big Tonga guy. And I was in a nun suit. And then, so she started questioning me, is that you? And I said, yeah, that's me. And she goes, did you shave your beard for the costume? Yeah, I shaved my beard for the costume. And she goes, that is the greatest costume. Yeah, so that was my part of the whole thing.
But I think you told me yesterday the ranger's name was Ivan.
Yeah.
You remember his last name?
Kasevic, yeah.
Okay. But he brought it in from Sequoia National Park?
Yeah, brought it in from Sequoia.
Wow.
And then it was flown in on a backhaul, so there was no extra flights or anything like that.
I only heard about it after it left. I didn't know there was a hot tub here, and I heard that there was a kerfuffle about it, but...
Yeah.
You know. Just to be clear, Ivan did not lose his job because of it, although I think he was disciplined.
Yeah, he just didn't... had to be off without pay. Him and Ray O'Neill.
Ray O'Neill, okay.
Yeah. But that's... Yeah. Rest you can find them about it.
Okay. Well, I'm sure there was, you know, I mean... I don't know what the illegality of it is, other than it's not a natural thing inside a national park. But, you know, a lot of these buildings are not natural either, but...
Yeah. Well, they, you know, I think they, it's, you know, like on the rim, don't they have, the kids have little pools and stuff?
Yeah, I mean...
Yeah, I think that's okay.
Yeah. Well, I mean, probably most everybody would agree that a hot tub down here probably isn't a good idea, but... It's hard to know why it's illegal or anything at all like that. I mean, yeah. I don't know.
Yeah. You got to find Ivan for that one.
Yeah. Well, since there was an investigation, if anybody wants to pursue that story a little bit more, there's probably a Freedom of Information Act that you can look at. And,
Yeah.
Well, anything else before we break for the day?
I think that's it for now. It's good.
Okay, that sounds good. And I think tomorrow what we'll do is maybe we can meet about 9 o'clock. I can come up to the Phantom Station and hook up with you, and then we'll walk through the whole grounds. We'll go from...
Yeah. Well, I see, the only thing I want to show you, you know, from the trees is start at that little nursery right there.
Yeah, okay.
And then move to the campground. And we can go there... When it's sunny again, like we did.
Okay.
Yeah, and then maybe not at first, but I can show you the where I start the germinate, and then show you what I do in the campground, because that's pretty much the area that I did it.
Well, thank you, Shores. This has been a really enjoyable day for me too, to hear your stories. Thank you very much.
Yeah, I'm glad it was you that came down.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm very glad that they asked me.